Well, this is a wonderful novel. I enjoyed it. It's very different. I haven't read anything quite like it. I think the most recent novel that had some similarities was the novel The World is Made of Fire by Mark Childress.
That one I don't know. Yeah, we saw it, but I don't know.
There are some similarities in the way it's written, the poetic passages, and also you have a fire that apparently is not a fire, but people think it's a fire.
A magic fire.
But Mark Childress' book is also built around a fire. Well, yours is not built around a fire, but there are these little touches there that seemed similar. And his was also a first novel.
Hmm.
But I think he's only about 24. It was a really nice start.
Hmm.
This is very well done. Let me, before I ask you about Things Invisible to See, I'd like to find out a little more about you. I know you're teaching at Vassar now, is that right?
Yeah. I teach a course in writing poetry at Vassar, and I've taught there for years.
For how long?
I ran out of graduate school. That's where I went, and I've never taught anywhere else. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and my father taught chemistry at the university there. I went to Stanford for a master's degree in medieval literature, back to the university for a doctor's degree in contemporary literature, and then to Vassar, where I've been teaching.
So as you grew up, you must have heard the chameleon that you refer to in your novel.
Oh, yeah.
Did you live near the campus then?
Oh, yeah, very close to it.
Why didn't you? You got your doctorate at the university.
And my undergraduate, too. I mean, Ann Arbor was the place where people went to college, went on to the university. Yeah. Went to high school there.
Why did you study medieval literature?
I was just interested in it. It's a time in history when so many of the arts come together, the music and the painting and the literature. There's a kind of synthesis. They relate in so many ways, and it's sort of unique in that way. And then I was just attracted to it because I like the poetry of the period, and I like the painting, and I like the music.
As you were growing up in a college atmosphere, I guess literature rubbed off on you to a great extent. When did you start writing poetry?
I started when I was a child. And I started writing when I was really little. The first thing I had wanted to write was a dream. And I was too little to write it down. And so I had carried it around in my head until I learned enough letters so I could write this dream down. I think that must have been one of the first things that I'd ever written. And then I did read a lot of books when I was growing up, but I also heard a lot of stories. I grew up in a family where people read out loud to each other. My mother loved to read out loud. I spent part of my childhood in a very small town in Michigan where for entertainment it was on a lake. We would go out in a rowboat with a pile of books, and my mother would read to us. She would drop anchor in the middle of the lake. Fishermen would give us dirty looks because we were making noise. And she would sometimes read whatever she happened to be reading. And so I'm used to hearing literature as well as reading it. And I hope that people read aloud what I write. I like to think that I'm writing things that are meant to be heard as well as to be read on the page. And in this community, this was a community that had no newspaper, it was so tiny. And my mother suggested that we should go, my sister and I could start our own newspaper there. And so we were kids. We were maybe 10, 12. And we did. We started a very small newspaper in this place. And I was the one reporter. I would go from door to door and ask, has anything happened in this house? And it was a community where nothing happened, or things that happened you couldn't really, they were not fit to print. But in doing that, I learned a lot about listening to people, how they talk, how they tell stories. And sometimes it isn't so much what happens, it's how the person tells it. I'm interested in this.
How did you print this little paper?
We had a hectograph press. My sister...
That's with the jelly?
With a jelly and a pencil, a special kind of pencil.
My sister, I used to have one of them. I did the same thing.
Oh, yeah. She would do the master carbon or the master sheet because she had good handwriting and I didn't. And then we would run it off and it would be strung up to dry all over the living room, and then the next day I would go out and deliver it. And it was very popular. People loved that paper.
One sheet at a time.
One sheet at a time.
And what a mess.
Oh, it was.
I'm glad to hear that somebody else did something like that.
No, we did that.
It's incredible when you think back at the difficulty we had in reproducing material in the past.
No Xerox.
No,
carbon
Xerox.
Paper, but we didn't have a typewriter.
So carbon paper and mimeograph. You had to cut stencils.
Yeah. No, it was complicated. So this was simple. Long, it took a long time, but it was very simple. Just took handwriting and this jelly.
And somebody asked me, a neighbor came knocking at my door one day and asked me for a sheet of carbon paper.
Oh.
And now, luckily I have some carbon paper that is very old and brittle, but I've gotten used to not even thinking in terms of carbon paper. If I have something to Xerox, come to the office. We have two Xerox machines and there are photocopying machines in the office, and I keep looking at the newspaper ads where the photocopiers are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, so one of these days everybody's going to have one. But I was talking to a writer named Vasily Aksionov. He's a Russian who has been stripped of his citizenship, and photocopying machines are against the law in the Soviet Union. So when he wrote anything, he would type as many carbons as he could. Hmm. But then he would pass it out, and then other people would type it.
Well, so it was handed around in manuscript. In
They wouldn't publish it. They wouldn't publish his work. So to get something spread around, even to the people who knew him, he would have to enlist other people to agree to write and on carbon. So
it's that a real
was
the underground only. Small press project in a way when it works. Yeah. I think also, I mean, I suppose the typewriter will soon be obsolete. Because of word processors and computers. I know a lot of my students work on computers. And I tried to get an old typewriter repaired and was told, we no longer make parts for this. If I'd brought in a Model T.
Isn't that scary, though? Scary. All the technology going ahead in the way that it does for someone like yourself, a poet who looks at things in such a romantic way.
My father was a scientist, so I'm not... I mean, I feel I have some kinship with science. And I like to read scientific literature. I like to read natural history and nonfiction. So I like to think that I'm as interested in some branches of science as I am in literature.
You have written a number of books of poetry and a number of books for children, is that correct?
And a book of critical essays. And
short stories.
A couple of books of short stories.
Tell me about your very first book.
The very first book was the first book was an inset in a magazine, Hornbook magazine. And I did it's a magazine, I think it comes out mostly for librarians. And they used to have a section of children's work. And I did an illustrated book, I did pen and ink drawings and a story. And they printed the whole book as an inset in their magazine. Then the second book, the real book that came out with its own covers, was a book that the University of Michigan student magazine did. They had a series of four student poets. And so my first book in that series, of course, was a poetry book.
Did they have to do it page by page with a jelly, did they?
No. Oh, things have gotten more complicated, a little easier.
This was a book of poems.
This was poetry, yeah. So I started writing poetry before I started doing fiction.
You say that as soon as you graduated, you went to Vassar to teach, is that correct?
Yeah.
So Vassar, in effect, has been your first job.
My first, and it's continued that way. And so I've seen it change from an all-girl institution to co-ed, which was an interesting thing to watch. And,
you're teaching poetry there.
I teach one class in writing poetry. And the interesting thing is, for me, the students that come into that class, I know they're not all going to be poets. I've had students who've gone into law school, who've gone on into, they've started into pre-med. So they come into it for many reasons. Many of them come into a class like that because they want to be able to read poetry. And by writing it for a year, they learn a lot about reading it. So I'm teaching both writers and readers in a class like that. And I learn a lot from just talking about in my craft and sharing ideas with students.
That's an interesting question that you raise. Why do people go to college, and why do the people who go to college study poetry? Because writing poetry, obviously, is not a lucrative field in order to do what one is going to have to teach or do something, usually teaching. Is it indeed to get a better understanding of the things around us?
Often it is. It's to get a better understanding. It's also to help people, to help them read it. But also another way of setting down one's experiences that perhaps can't be set down in prose. I think that's why some of them come in there. It attracts a great variety of students, and that's one reason that I enjoy teaching that class.
Vassar, of course, is a college on the upscale. What are your students like?
They come from all backgrounds. And they're all very bright and very interesting. Often I keep in touch with them after they've graduated, so we have friendships that develop out of these classes. A lot of them go into publishing, or at least a lot of my students have. They're an interesting group of people. I'm delighted, you know, to have a chance to get to know them.
Ms. Vassar has a literary tradition, isn't it? Oh, Mary McCarthy, didn't she center the group there?
Oh, yes. Mary McCarthy, Elizabeth Bishop, Mira Ruckheiser. All sorts of people have come from there.
Well, let's go on to Things Invisible to See. This is a novel, of course, your first novel. Did you have any difficulty in making the transition from writing poetry, which is usually very short, to something as ambitious as a novel?
No, because I've also written fiction for adults, and I've written some very long stories. And I suppose I chose a novel for this because the story that I wanted to tell had to be told from many points of view. It covered a long period of time, and so it had to be a novel rather than a long short story. And I enjoyed working on that. It was exhausting.
Yeah,
I was glad to have written it,
yeah.
But I did enjoy it.
How did you approach it? Did you make yourself an outline, or did you do this in kind of a spontaneous way? For example, did you know that you were going to have this baseball game of death and life at the very end?
I knew that something like that would have to come at the end. You have a feeling sometimes, as when you tell stories, which I like to do, the shape of the whole thing is with you, and then you work it out step by step. But you know, as in a journey, you know where you're going to end up or where you hope you'll end up. Knowing, of course, that you can always change the map along the way if something really exciting comes along. But I did have the baseball game in mind at the end, since we're baseball fans in our family.
Well, what did you decide as you started to write this novel? I'm going to write about two twin brothers with different characters and the things that happened to them and the people around them in this small town in the 1940s. I mean, what did you decide?
I always start with the lives of the characters, rather than with ideas about the characters or ideas about the book. I start with thinking, well, once upon a time, there was a boy named Ben, and he got to know a girl named Claire, and she had these people in her family. I think very much in terms of the people. And for me, the stories arise from the people. It's their stories that I tell. Then I can look afterwards and say, oh, I meant this, there are connections here. But I don't worry about what a book means. I really worry about getting the story down and being as faithful to my characters as it's possible.
Why did you select the 1940s? And, of course, you're too young to remember.
I remember some of that. I was a child during the Second World War, and it's a period that has always interested me. When I read history, that's one period that I like to read in. And when I worked on that book, I went back to Ann Arbor and looked through the Ann Arbor News, the issues for that period of time, starting around October before Pearl Harbor, up through June. So that since I was writing about such outrageous and fantastic things, ancestresses arriving, people in out-of-the-body travel experiences, then I wanted to be especially accurate about the facts, the historical facts. So when Willie goes to a movie with Marcia in the scene in Ann Arbor, the movie that I have them talk about going to see, it was really playing in Ann Arbor at that time. That kind of historical accuracy I tried to be very careful about. I had maps of Ann Arbor that I was using so that I knew what I was talking about when I looked at, I had a sense of place.
Didn't you feel you were treading a dangerous line, this line between fantasy and, or I don't know if I would call it fantasy, fact and, all right, well, let's call it fantasy.
All right.
I don't know if that's quite what I wanted to say, but it is certainly not within the realm of the real.
All right. I mean, fantasy for me is not an escape from the real. It's very much grounded in the real. I suppose partly because the kind of family I was brought up in taught me this. These out-of-the-body experiences, these visions, really come from stories that I heard as a child that happened to people in my family. And so when you talk about fantasy and real, it simply depends on your experience. That is, what is fantastic to someone, maybe perfectly natural to me, or what is supernatural to someone may not be that supernatural to me, because I know people who've lived through these things who've told me that they have.
Well, wait a minute. Let's back up. Your father was a scientist. How did you be exposed to all this supernatural
stuff? Because in my mother's family, And also my father's family, there were women. It always seemed to happen to women who had these kinds of experiences. The vision of the young girl standing on this, on one side of the river and all the ancestors, the dead on the other side, waving her over. That was a vision that happened to an aunt of mine who was at death's door because her appendix burst when she was young. And this was when she came back from what was almost death. She told the people that this is what it was like. This is what she had seen. My father's sister had had a similar experience, so we had this on both sides of the family. When her father died, she was far away from him, but she knew. She saw the whole thing in her mind. It was as if he had come back to say goodbye to her. And she confirmed the accuracy of this vision with the doctor. There was no way she could have known the moment in which she died and how it happened, but she saw it all, and she seemed to have seen what in fact did happen. And I don't know how you explain those things. I keep an open mind on the subject, but I did grow up with these stories in our house.
Having written things invisible to see must have given you a great deal of satisfaction, but do you miss the poetry? Or do you feel that you're so comfortable with the fiction now that take poetry in its
stride? No, I go back and forth. I'm working on some children's books now, also poetry. I don't think in terms of, well, I shall now do only novels or only fiction. I think in terms of the individual project. Now I'm going to finish a book for children. Next month I'm going to do poetry. It's always the individual thing that you're working on that you care about. And then you look back over your shoulder and you see what you have written, but you don't plan it all out in advance.
You're a person who works with young people. You teach on the college level and you write books for children. Are you concerned with the technological explosion today, the audiovisual explosion, and what it may or may not be doing to our reading habits?
I worry a little about that. I worry about what television may be doing to reading habits. But there's also a movement in this country to go back to storytelling. There's an organization called the National Association for the Preservation and Perpetuation of Storytelling, which has branches and storytelling groups all over America. And I find, especially among people who work with children, teachers, librarians, that this is a growing concern and a growing interest. Storytelling has been used with elderly people. It's been used with autistic children, with mentally disturbed people, and it's been used in the classroom. And that, I think, will bring people back to reading, if it is ever, if in fact children are reading less. This I don't know for a fact.
No, I don't either. There are some indications that I get from Reading Publishers Weekly that there are more readers, book readers, today than before, but then we have more people in the world today. But by the same token, we've made book reading easier for people in many respects. Back in the 1930s, there were only 500 bookstores in the late 1930s in the entire United States. And now there are thousands of them, and books are found in outlets everywhere, drugstores.
And paperback books. Paperback books. Which I think that's marvelous for children, because children go through books so quickly and are often very hard on them. And so children can afford to buy books. And I think this must have made a difference in people's reading habits.
Well, by the same token, most adults probably read paperback books. I've talked to adults who prefer paperbacks because they feel intimidated by a hardcover. There's something more difficult about a hardcover book, but a paperback they can read and leaf through it and throw around. And
I think children feel this way. They can put a paperback book in the back of your jeans pocket or in your lunchbox, and it's all right. It's, you know, it's not quite such a problem carrying it around. I think if parents read to their children out loud, I don't know how many parents do this, and I say I grew up being read to, it would encourage children to read. I've been told this by librarians and teachers, that children who have been read to when they are small never have trouble reading when they're adults. And they go on to love books.
Who do you like to read today?
Oh, I like to read. I read all kinds of things. I read a lot of nonfiction. I like natural history.
Nonfiction? What
nonfiction.
Kind?
Nonfiction. Mostly natural history, animal kind,
natural history.
Things like this. David Attenborough. Ah, yeah. Just that kind of things that I can, things that are very visible to see. I like to read poetry. I read a lot of children's books and a lot of folklore and earlier literature.
Who are some of the poets you like?
I like Galway Canal, and I like earlier poetry. And I go back and reread. I reread Whitman. I reread Rilke. I like poetry that can be heard, that's meant to be read out loud. That's something that's important to me.
Do you have a busy teaching schedule that makes it difficult for you to find time to write, or does it space out pretty well for you?
Well, I used to teach full-time. and that meant a lot of students and a lot of papers. And then I found when my son was little that I wasn't going to have a chance to see him grow up if I was all so busy in teaching. So then I went part-time so that I would have time to write and time to spend with students and then time to watch my son grow up, because I didn't want to miss that for anything.
Well, Nancy Willard, it sounds as though you're the best of all worlds and a wonderful start in fiction. And I'm very anxious to see what you'll be doing in the future, and I hope that you'll come back and talk to me about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.